Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we continue now the study of the, what I call the Word of the Buddha, by investigating the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the middle-length discourses of the Buddha. And we interrupted our investigation, I believe it was the first week of last August, and it's been a rather long interruption, for which I apologize, but as they say, the interruption was for reasons which could not be prevented. And before we go further in our study, for the benefit of those people who are new to the course and also to refresh the memories of those of you who attended previously, I want to do a kind of recapitulation of the territory that we've covered so far. Since I've arranged the study of the suttas in a somewhat systematic, according to a somewhat systematic structure or pattern, okay, we began with a number of suttas which deal with the enlightenment of the Buddha, and the purpose of taking these suttas is first to show the Buddha's own quest for enlightenment. There's something of an archetypal pattern that all Buddhist followers undergo in their own development along the Buddhist path. One begins as an ordinary, pardon me, ignorant worldling enmeshed within the delusions of the unenlightened mind, enmeshed within the sufferings, within the entertainments and diversions of samsaric existence, and then through the experience of suffering, one becomes awakened to the need to emerge from these delusions, these entertainments and diversions, and come to some realization of some unconditioned truth. Okay, so the study of the Buddha's enlightenment is to establish, or to examine the Buddha's early life quest for enlightenment as a kind of pattern for our own pursuit of the Buddha's path, and also to establish the credentials or authority of the Buddha as a teacher, as one who has truly achieved what we call Anuttara Samma Sambodhi, the supreme perfect enlightenment. Of course, when we study these suttas, we cannot actually verify or testify to the fact or truth of the Buddha's enlightenment, but we see that the texts do assert that the Buddha has achieved the supreme enlightenment. The second section of our study shows the way a potential or prospective disciple of the Buddha should approach the teaching, approach the Dhamma. We call a wise, prudent, cautious way to approach the teaching. One doesn't approach through blind faith, through emotional devotion. One doesn't approach through a kind of just an emotional commitment. But the Buddha himself encourages those who come to his teaching to make an investigation of the teaching. And one begins the investigation by considering those aspects of the teaching which pertain to one's own immediate life, those which pertain to qualities of the mind that we could see within ourselves. The Buddha makes a very clear and sharp distinction between certain qualities of mind which are unwholesome, detrimental to our own well-being, detrimental to others. These are called unwholesome states. Other states of mind, other mental qualities, which are beneficial to ourselves, beneficial to others. And so we begin by seeing that if we allow the first type of states of mind to grow, to take control of ourselves, to take control of our lives, to motivate our conduct, this will lead to harm and suffering for ourselves and others. Whereas if we make an effort to eliminate those states and to develop the pure, wholesome, and beneficial states, it will lead to the well-being of ourselves and others. So without any emotional commitment, without any blind faith, one enters the Dhamma just by seeing the need to eliminate those qualities which are harmful and destructive to oneself and others, and to cultivate, develop, fulfill, and perfect those qualities which are beneficial to oneself and others. Okay, that is the approach the Buddha takes in the famous Kalama Sutta. And this is developed somewhat more elaborately with reference to a wide variety of speculative views in the Appanaka Sutta. Then in the Vimamsaka Sutta, the Buddha invites the prospective disciple to test the Buddha himself, to investigate the Buddha himself. He says, don't even leave me out of the picture, but look at my own behavior. See whether in my behavior I betray any traces of greed, aversion, delusion. And place faith in me, place confidence in me, place trust in me, only if you can be sure that I myself and my conduct show that I am one who is free from greed, hatred, and ignorance. And then in the Chanki Sutta, the Buddha lays out a pattern or a system by which one tests the faith that one places in him. One begins by placing faith in the sense of confidence or trust. Through that faith, one takes up the practice. By taking up the practice, one develops step by step until one reaches some penetration or realization of the teaching. And it is through that realization or penetration that one confirms the faith that one placed in the Buddha. And it's through that penetration or realization that one practices further until one comes to full attainment. Okay, so those suttas deal with the approach to the Dhamma. Then I took a number. Okay, so in this group we have the suttas dealing with the approach to the Dhamma. Now, in the next stage of our investigation, I laid out a scheme of three types of benefits to which the Buddha's teaching is directed. This is a classical scheme developed in the commentaries. Have these finished and done with? Okay, so we have these three, what I call these three domains of the teaching. The first is three goals of the teaching, and each goal demarcates a particular domain of the Dharma. The first goal is well-being and happiness in this present life, well-being and happiness in this present life with respect to mundane benefits. What I mean is that the Buddha will teach, for example, parents how to bring up their children, children how they should respect and care for their parents. He'll teach husband how to care for the wife how to care for the husband. He teaches rulers, the kings, how to look after the subjects. He'll teach citizens how to fulfill their civil duties, their responsibilities. So people sometimes think the Buddha was just like an otherworldly teacher, trying to lead all of his disciples to nirvana, some kind of otherworldly bliss. But if you really read the suttas, the ancient texts, you see that the Buddha dealt with so many aspects of just day-to-day mundane existence. We don't find that that many in the Majjhima Nikaya, but there are many suttas of this type in another collection, the Anguttara Nikaya. And then also he would deal with the very mundane concerns of the monastic order, even explaining to the monks how to build a latrine, a proper latrine, how to build a bathhouse, resolving quarrels amongst the monks, making many, many regulations, rules and regulations, then regulating establishing the relations, the proper relations between the monastic community and the lay community. All of these are aspects of establishing mundane well-being and happiness. And then the Buddha would also try to resolve conflicts and quarrels between different social groups, different communities. Okay, then the second goal is concerned with the life beyond this present life, that is, with the next existence or with our future lives within the round of rebirth. And this is called well-being and happiness in future lives, or in Pali, Samparayika Hita Sukha. And from this perspective, then the teachings of the law of karma and the teaching on rebirth becomes very relevant. And here the ethical teachings also come into play. So we have the Buddha teaching laying special stress on the 10, what are called the 10 pathways of wholesome karma. The need to avoid the 10 pathways of unwholesome karma or of unskillful action. The need to fulfill, to complete, to master the 10 pathways of wholesome action. The need to generate merit, to perform virtuous actions in order to secure for oneself a happy rebirth in the future. And so we studied a number of suttas which pertain to this particular domain of the teaching. But then when we come to the next section in our study, we investigated a number of suttas which I call that section deepening one's perspective on the world. And in that section we studied suttas which point out the flaws and defects in mundane life. And from this perspective, existence in any type of mundane life, or life in any type of mundane existence, is flawed and defective. Any type of existence is necessarily impermanent. One arises, exists for a certain amount of time, then that lifespan comes to an end, one passes away to take rebirth elsewhere. One enjoys in the span of one's life, one enjoys the pleasures of the senses, but those sensual pleasures are all ultimately lacking. They're impermanent. One gets pleasure temporarily, the pleasures fade away. One becomes obsessed by the need for more pleasures, and so one just becomes driven in this cycle of pleasure, satisfaction, more craving, more enjoyment, more craving. And so that cycle goes on and on and on. And this is what drives one through this round of existence. Then we took a selection of suttas from the Samyutta Nikaya, short suttas, which highlight, which underscore the misery of samsara, the misery of this perpetual wandering through the round of rebirth, going from one life to the next. The Buddha says we shed tears, which in volume is greater than the waters of the four great oceans. And as we go from life to life, we shed blood, which is in volume is greater than the water of the four great oceans. And so when one takes that deeper perspective on the world and sees that life in any conditioned realm of existence is impermanent, unsatisfactory, without any substance, without any true, deep satisfaction, then one is led to pursue the ultimate goal, the highest good. This is the supreme well-being and happiness. This is the happiness of liberation, nirvana, nibbana. And that is the paramatta hita sukha. And so now we come to section 5 of our program of study. These are suttas dealing with the path to liberation. And I began with 2 suttas on the purpose of the spiritual life. The first is the shorter discourse to Malankya, Malankyaputta. This is the famous story of the monk who wanted to have his questions answered, the speculative questions about whether the universe is infinite or finite, eternal or non-eternal, whether the soul is the same as the body, different from the body, and so on. And he refused. He told the Buddha that you better give me the answers to these questions, otherwise I will leave you. Then the Buddha related to him this famous simile about the man who has been hit by a poisoned arrow. His friends bring the physician, a surgeon, to remove the arrow. And the man says, I won't let you take out the arrow until you tell me the name of the man who shot me, the type of arrow that he used to hit me, the material that the bow was made out of, and all the information about where the man learned, acquired his skill in archery, and so on and so forth. And so that man who's hit by the arrow would die before he learns the answers to these questions. And so the Buddha says that I'm not teaching the Dhamma in order to satisfy your curiosity about these questions, but to show you the way to liberation from suffering. Okay, so that sutta establishes that the purpose of the spiritual life is not to answer our speculative questions. And now we come to the sutta that we're going to deal with tonight, the Mahasaropama Sutta, which deals with the purpose of the spiritual life from another angle. So now we can take our books. Now I've sort of finished summing up what was about 7 months of study in a half an hour. And now we come into new territory. This is now we come to Sutta number 29. Mahasaropama Sutta. This is the greater discourse on the simile of the heartwood. The key word here is sara. Sara, it's an interesting word because it has several nuances. Originally, it is like in a tree, there are different types of wood, and the outer wood is called the soft wood, paguna. And when you remove the soft wood, then you come to the inner wood, which is the hard wood, the core of the tree, or the heartwood, sara. And so that word sara means, on the one hand, it's the heartwood, but it also takes on the meaning of the core or essence of anything, the substance. Philosophically, you say that the Buddha, since he teaches not non-self, anatta, we say everything is without any sara, without any essence. But looked at from another perspective, the Buddha teaches the true sara, the true essence, the true heart of the spiritual life. And that will be the topic, the theme of this sutta. And this sutta was spoken in reference to a particular incident, which is referred to in the first paragraph. The sutta opens when the Buddha was living near the town of Rajagaha on the mountain called Vulture's Peak. And this was soon after the monk named Devadatta had left the order. And who is this Devadatta? Devadatta was a cousin of the Buddha who had become a monk after the Buddha had returned to his home city, his native city, and preached the Dhamma. And when the Buddha had returned to his native city, then many of his relatives, his male relatives had renounced the home life and had become monks under him, including the famous monk Ananda, who was his constant companion in his later years, but also this cousin named Devadatta. And Devadatta began as a very devoted and diligent monk, but at a certain point in his career, evil desires came into the mind, and he became envious of the Buddha, ambitious, but earlier he had been quite successful in his meditation at a mundane level, and he had developed very strong samadhi, meditative concentration, and he had been able to use that samadhi to develop what are called the iddhis. These are supernormal powers, spiritual powers. Okay, so when the Buddha was in his old age, then the idea came to Devadatta that he should get control of the order, the Sangha, and become the leader. And so he came to the Buddha and said, "Venerable Sir, isn't it about time that you entered a retirement home? We could arrange a nice home for you, and you know, you need a successor, and I'm around. I'll take over. I'll take over all your responsibilities. You just take it easy in your last years, and let me fulfill all of the responsibilities." And the Buddha, he understood Devadatta's mind, and he refused quite bluntly and said, "I would never hand the order over to you." And Devadatta was quite upset by this, and he was decided to scheme. And so he used his supernormal powers, and he knew that King Bimbisara was the king of the state of Magadha. Bimbisara was getting old, and the successor to the throne was the prince named Ajatasattu. So Devadatta used his psychic powers to suddenly appear. He projected himself into the chamber, the private chamber of the young prince Ajatasattu. And he appeared as a handsome, beautiful young man with a cobras all around his body. Cobras wiggling over the body. And so when Ajatasattu came into the chamber, he saw this handsome young man with cobras winding and twisting over the body, and he was frightened and terrified. Then Devadatta, through just an act of will, he made that young man disappear, and he reappeared in his own form as Devadatta and said, "Don't be afraid, Prince. It's only me. I'm just trying to show you what a great yogi I am." And Prince Ajatasattu was one of the types who was very impressed by people with... it's part of the temperament of those who are inclined to power, is that they're impressed by people who have spiritual powers. Maybe that's why kings, very prominent people, or politicians, movie actors, actresses, they're always seeking out yogis in the Himalayas with spiritual powers. So he's very impressed by this mystical yogi, and so he became his humble disciple and said, "What can I do for you, sir?" And he said, "Well, your father's getting old, our Buddha's getting old. Why don't you eliminate your father and help me eliminate our old Buddha? And so you become the king, I'll become the Buddha, and then we can form a mutual, an alliance of mutual support." And so Devadatta then convinced Ajatasattu to take steps that would eventually lead to Ajatasattu killing his father. And then Ajatasattu provided assassins to try to assassinate the Buddha. But these plots of assassination failed, since each time the assassins were so impressed by the presence of the Buddha that they would throw away their weapons and they became followers of the Buddha. Then Ajatasattu, Devadatta, the next time he decided that he would try to kill the Buddha himself. So one time when the Buddha used to pace up and down just below this Vulture Peak mountain. So Devadatta climbed up the mountain and he took a boulder. There was a boulder right at the edge of the cliff, and he pushed that boulder down the cliff just when the Buddha was walking below. But the boulder missed the Buddha. It missed the Buddha, but it hit another rock, and a splint came off that rock, hit the Buddha's foot, and wounded the Buddha, cut the Buddha's foot so the foot was bleeding. Then the Buddha looked up the mountain, and he saw Devadatta standing there, and he warned him, "What you are doing is very dangerous." But still Devadatta was not deterred from his plot. The next time, his next plot, his next way of trying to assassinate or kill the Buddha, he got an elephant, a mad elephant. He got the elephant drunk, and when the Buddha was walking down the street on arms round, he had the elephant released from its stable and sent it straight at the Buddha. And the Buddha was walking down the road accompanied by the Venerable Ananda, and the elephant came charging at the Buddha full speed ahead. And there was just Ananda and the Buddha walking down the road. And as they walked, Ananda saw the elephant coming and said, "I'll step in front of you, sir, and protect you." But the Buddha said, stay where you are. And the elephant came running. And just as it approached the Buddha was radiating his loving kindness towards the elephant. The elephant was coming closer. And just when it was a few yards away, it came within the aura of the Buddha's radiation of loving kindness. And it was just completely softened by that loving kindness till it bowed down at the Buddha's feet and worshipped him. Then softly, quietly, gently walked away. So then when this fell, then Devadatta saw that all of his plots had failed. And so he got a group of young monks to follow him. He convinced them that he was a very wise, enlightened man. And he broke away from the Sangha and tried to form a rival party, a rival monastic order. And this is the event that's referred to at the beginning of the sutra. Okay, so now we come to the text itself. And now here the Buddha is referring to Devadatta and he's addressing the monks. So the text itself, it doesn't make any direct reference to Devadatta, but we could see that Devadatta is behind the sutra. Okay, here some clansmen, perhaps you could render this more freely as a young man, or maybe a young man or woman, goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Okay, this opening, this is a repetitive passage, a passage which we come across very often in the suttas, and it shows the initial reflection which leads a person to enter upon the path to deliverance, we call the path to the ultimate good, the ultimate goal. And though in the Buddha's time this is phrased in terms of one going out from the home life, literally going out from the home life into homelessness, I think in our own time we might give this a wider significance of one who is, in a metaphorical sense, going out from this worldly life upon the path that will lead to ultimate liberation, whether one is taking that radical step of actually taking formal monastic ordination or not. But if one is entering upon that super mundane or transcendental dharma, the dharma which leads to the super mundane goal, then one can be said metaphorically to have gone forth from the home life into homelessness. And one does so through this reflection upon one's own existential condition. Normally, most people just take their own life for granted. They don't consider the fact, or if they consider, they just consider it in a very conventional way, that they are subject to aging and death. But now one is considering this as a fact that one is facing starkly, right in its face. That one is subject to, now one has been born, and now one has to face old age and death. Once one undergoes death, again one has to face birth, and again go through aging and death. As one does so, one undergoes sorrow, lamentation, pain, physical pain, mental pain or grief and despair. And so one is a victim of dukkha. Dukkha is something wider than just suffering, but it's this whole unsatisfactoriness, this inadequacy, this flawed nature of existence. And now one goes forth with some confidence, some trust, some faith that it is possible to put an end to this whole mass of suffering. And so one goes forth, and when one does so, this is one of the, one meets the first big obstacle or danger. This is a danger particularly in the monastic life and particularly in within the context of ancient Indian society or in any traditional Buddhist country. One is accorded a great deal of gain, this offering, honor. People will praise you, give you a lot of respect, veneration, esteem, and renown. People will spread your good name around. They will speak very highly of you. Sometimes one achieves some accomplishments, one becomes famous. And so this becomes a pitfall or obstacle to one's further progress. In the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a whole group of suttas, a whole collection called the Connected Discourses on Gain, Honor, and Fame, in which the Buddha speaks about the dangers of gain, honor, and fame. And he says that the gain, honor, and fame, he compares it to a fisherman's hook. He says that just as a fisherman might throw with his fishing rod, he throws the hook into the pool, and the fish comes along thinking that he'll get a nice meal, swallows the hook with the bait on it. And when he swallows the bait, the hook gets caught in his belly and he's trapped. He's finished. So gain, honor, and fame, that becomes the big obstacle to spiritual progress. And how this comes about? Okay, this new young monk, Venerable Sir, please take this. Please receive this. He's given so many offerings. Maybe he's come from a poor village family. Suddenly, everything he wants. May I bring you some of this, Venerable? May I give you some of that, Venerable? So, all of these gains, these honors, and now he becomes swollen, pleased, uplifted. And, that thought, I went forth to get out of suffering. Where is it? It's gone. But now his intention is fulfilled. Now he's satisfied, no longer thinks about that original purpose. And now, because he is honored and praised and receives so much gain, now he starts praising himself and disparaging others. And here I think, of course, the Buddha is referring obliquely to Devadatta, because he was being honored and praised by this prince, Ajatasattu. But here this monk is now thinking, I have gained honor and renown, but the other monks are unknown, of no account. Then he becomes intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown. He grows negligent. He falls into negligence, and being negligent, he lives in suffering. Okay, so I tried to map out pattern here.
It was written so beautifully, it seems almost like a crime.
No, I'll erase this. Everybody has copied this.
No, don't go there.
No, it'll take too long. Okay, so as a result of gain, honor, and renown, first he becomes pleased and his purpose is fulfilled.
You can call it complacency. You become complacent
or self-satisfied. That is, one loses sight of the higher purpose and one settles down to a rather comfortable level of being satisfied with the mediocre. Then next comes self-praise and disparaging others. So we could call self-praise is maybe pride or vanity, and disparaging of others is contempt. Okay, then one becomes intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown. I don't want to use the word intoxication. We might call this pride. Well, let's call this addiction. We'll say that he becomes addicted to the gain, honor, and renown.
And then that will be followed by negligence.
And then the ultimate consequence is suffering. Okay, so these are the consequences that come not from acquiring gain, honor, and renown per se, but from becoming pleased with that gain, honor, and renown. And now the Buddha illustrates this with a simile. And this, again, is just one of the most impressive things about the early suttas to me, is the way the similes perfectly illustrate the points of the teaching. Okay, here we have a man who needs heartwood, wants to make something, maybe to build a table, a solid table with some solid wood from the tree. And so he comes to the tree seeking some heartwood, and instead of cutting through the log of wood and going straight for the core of the trunk, he just passes that all over, and he cuts off the twigs and leaves, takes them away, thinking he's going to build a solid table or a desk from the twigs and leaves. And then a man with good sight is watching him, and he concludes, this man doesn't know anything about what is heartwood, what is sapwood, what is inner bark, outer bark, twigs or leaves. And whatever it is that he wants to make with the heartwood, his purpose will not succeed because he's made a disastrous mistake in taking away these twigs and leaves in order to construct a table out of them. Okay, that's the same way of some monk here who has gone forth from the home life into homelessness. He wants to make an end of suffering to reach the ultimate nirvana, and he thinks he can do so just by becoming satisfied with gain, honor, and fame and not going any further. Okay, now we'll come to the next step, next section of the sutta. The sutta is very repetitive, so we could really simplify just by stripping away the repetition. Okay, now we come to another person who has gone forth from the home life into homelessness with the same purpose in view. When he goes forth, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. That is natural. It comes to him. But he is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown. Not that he is angry or upset by it, but it's just like water off the duck's back. It just flows off him. It comes to him, but he's not attached to it. And his intention is not fulfilled. He's not... really, he doesn't settle down in it. Okay, so he goes on and on till he's diligent. He doesn't become negligent. He's diligent, and he achieves the attainment of virtue. Virtue here is sila, or jia. He observes the precepts. He's very upright, virtuous, scrupulous in observing the precepts. Maybe he studies the Vinaya, the code of discipline, observes the Pratimoksha, the collection of monastic precepts, write to the letter very diligently, and so his conduct becomes very pure, very well disciplined. But some people become fixed upon the observance of precepts, and so they think that the whole of the spiritual life is just a matter of paying very minute and devoting very minute and detailed attention to the precepts. And so then he becomes, at a certain point, he becomes pleased with his achievements in the sphere of virtue. And his whole purpose is now fulfilled in observing the precepts. His intention is fulfilled. And then once the intention is fulfilled, now a certain dark quality starts to flow into the mind. Maybe he began observing the precepts sincerely with a very upright, righteous character, but now a certain dark quality of pride starts flowing into the mind. And so he starts praising himself, congratulating himself, and disparaging others, looking down on others. He says, I am virtuous, of good character. These other monks are immoral, of bad character. And so then he becomes intoxicated with that attainment of virtue. That is, he becomes, he has addiction here. He grows negligent. He doesn't attend to the higher stages of the practice. And so being negligent, he lives in suffering. This is like a man who goes in search of heartwood. Now, this is a man who, this man, he doesn't take the twigs and foliage like the other person, the twigs and leaves, but he cuts off the outer bark and takes it away. He wants to make his table from the outer bark of the tree. And so this man, too, doesn't understand what is the real heartwood of the tree. And so the person who goes forth into the homeless life, wanting to put an end to suffering, to reach the ultimate nibbana, but then just becomes satisfied with very scrupulous and diligent observing of the precepts, the virtue, that is like one who is taken the outer bark of the holy life and stopped short with that. Okay, next, we come to a person, again, who goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness. I promised myself that I would give the class from 7 to 8. So what I think I'm going to do, just leave time for questions, if there are any, then continue the sutta next time. And next time, I will finish this easily enough, and I'll start the next sutta next time. So, if there are questions, please feel welcome to ask, either on anything of the review that we did, or anything that we've covered, though we've covered just a little. That's an interesting point. I didn't want to go into too much detail, but one of the sort of ways in which Devadatta tried to create the schism in the Sangha was he came to the Buddha and he made an appeal to the Buddha that the Buddha should institute 5 measures. The 5 measures were that monks should always live, let me see if I could remember them. They should always live at the root of a tree, that they should not live in dwellings, that they should always live in the forest, not live in the village, that they should always wear red robes, that they should not accept robes which are ready-made by householders, that they should only eat vegetarian food, but they should not eat fish or meat, and that they should eat only food which has been collected on alms round, but that they should not accept invitations to meals. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now the Buddha said, I allow, okay, one who wants to live at the root of a tree can do so. One who wants to live in a more comfortable dwelling can do so. One who wants to live only in the forest can do so. One who wants to live in the town could do so. But he said, with regard to the one who wants to live under the tree, he can do so during most of the year, except during the rainy season. According to the rules, during the rainy season, he has to live in a sheltered dwelling. With regard to the other rules, it's left up to the discretion of the monk. If he wants to live in the village, he could do so. If he wants to live in the forest, he can do so. If he wants to wear only the rag robes, he could do so. If he wants to accept robes that are ready-made, which are offered by lay people, he could do so. If he wants to collect food, to eat food only that he collects an alms round, he could do so. Otherwise, he could accept food which is offered by householders, which is brought to the monastery, which is offered in the homes of householders. Okay, now, the Buddha would have had, at that point, no reason to expel him from the Sangha. The Buddha's Devadatta's intention was to create a schism, but Devadatta didn't say that he's intending to create a schism. He's requesting the Buddha to lay down these rules. Now, sort of the point of the rules is to try to make the Sangha an exclusively ascetic order, because Devadatta is thinking that people admire asceticism. And so he wants to be like more ascetic than the Buddha, and to force the monks to be more ascetic in their observances than they actually are. Whereas the Buddha knew that first, since he was establishing a very large order, he had to make accommodations for the temperaments and modes of practice of different types of monks. And also, I think this is part of the Buddha's method of instituting the Dharma in the world. If he laid down very strict ascetic rules, the Buddhist Sangha would have been just like one of the other ascetic orders in India in that period, which would have been remote from cities and villages. It would have consisted just of yogis living in seclusion, and it wouldn't have had much interaction with lay people. Whereas I think the Buddha wanted to create a Sangha which did have interaction with lay people and which was able to present the teachings to lay people for their benefit. Okay, so when the Buddha refused the request of Devadatta, then Devadatta knew that he had now some ammunition in his pistol, so to speak, for creating a schism. And that was the argument that he used to convince the group of young monks, newly ordained monks, that he was superior to the Buddha. So then he convinced those newly ordained monks. He said, how can you be following this fellow? Look at the way he's letting the monks live. So lax, so slack. The monks are just hanging around in their temples, in their monasteries. People are bringing them food. We want to go off. We want to live like real, striving ascetics, going around with alms bowls from house to house, not getting these fancy Madison Avenue style, Fifth Avenue robes. We're just going to pick up rags and sew our own robes. No living in these mansions. We'll live at the foot of trees. We'll show those Buddhist monks up. And so they were convinced, according to the text, they say 500 young monks. Of course, 500 is usually an exaggerated figure, just to show a large number. So that all of those young monks, they were impressed, and they broke away, and they went off, and then Devadatta set up this little order of his own, with himself sitting in like the lion's seat. That was after. At that point, Devadatta was still a member of the Buddhist order. It wasn't yet a cause for expulsion. Yeah. In fact, he wasn't actually expelled on his... But the Buddha had already issued a kind of decree or edict that whatever... He asked Sariputta and Moggallana, the two chief disciples, to tell people that whatever Devadatta does on his own should not be taken as representing the Buddhist order, but just as representing the personal opinion of Devadatta. But Devadatta was still a member of the Buddhist order, even though he'd made these assassination attempts at the Buddha. But there was no attempt made to expel him. And it was only when he left on his own together with the group of monks that he now considered himself to have broken away from the Buddhist order and to have established a separate order of his own, which would be like now a different religion, so to speak, a different monastic community, not no longer the Buddha Sangha. But then the Buddha sent Sariputta and Moggallana again to find out what Devadatta was doing. And so when Sariputta and Moggallana arrived at Devadatta's place, Devadatta saw them coming, and he said to his group of new followers, he said, "See, now Sariputta and Moggallana have come to join me." And so Devadatta, he was sort of imitating the Buddha, and said, after preaching to them, he said, "Well, I am tired, I am going to lie down a little while. I will let Sariputta speak to you." And so he said, "Sariputta, speak to these young monks," and Devadatta lay down on his side the way the Buddha used to, but Devadatta fell asleep. And while he was sleeping, Sariputta convinced the young monks that Devadatta was a schismatic and was evil-minded, and then he convinced the young monks to come back and join the Buddha. And so when Devadatta woke up, he found that all of the monks had vanished and he was left alone. Any further questions? Okay, then we'll continue next week. And does anybody need a copy of the syllabus? Did everybody get a copy? It's the same syllabus that I gave out at the beginning of the course. Last year. Okay, so we close with the sharing of the merit. I think the sheet has been given out to the site of offices. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mantaram. Etavata caham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.